Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, hello and welcome back to New Books in Medieval History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Evan Zarkadas, your host, and today we will be talking to Dr. Angeliki Limberopoulou, Senior Lecturer in Art History at the Open University in the United Kingdom, to talk about her new book, Cross-Cultural Interaction Between Byzantium and the West, 1204 to 1669, Whose Mediterranean Is It Anyway? Published in 2018 by the Society for the Promotion of Byzantine Studies and the Routledge Publications. The aim of this volume is to address, explore, re-examine, and reinterpret this specific aspect of cross-cultural interaction in the Mediterranean, that between the Byzantine East and the mainly Italian West. And the investigation of this interaction has become increasingly popular, as the book states, in the past few decades, due to the relevance it has for cultural exchanges and our everyday society. Hello, Angeliki. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
Absolutely. We are very happy as well. Angeliki, I wonder if you begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Of course, as you said, my name is Angeliki Limberopoulou. Obviously, I'm a Greek. You can probably hear it from my accent. I was born and raised in Greece. In fact, I attended the university, the University of Rethymnon in Crete. I am from Crete, where I studied archaeology and history of art. I had excellent professors there. Professors were very well known around the world. Had Maria Vasilaki in Byzantine archaeology, Nikolaos Hadzinikolaou in art history, Nikolaos Stambolidis in classical art. I was very, very lucky. And then in 1992, I moved to United Kingdom. I thought I was going to do 2 years, a diploma and a master's, and just thought I was going to go back to Greece. I studied at the Courtauld Institute of Art. But then I moved on to do a PhD in Birmingham with the great Leslie Brubaker. And here I am, 29 years and counting. Again, very lucky in Birmingham. I was in the center, fantastic center, with Leslie Brubaker. And my examiner in my PhD was Liz James. I have been very lucky in my life with my teachers, I suppose. But I need to say that originally I had no plans of studying Byzantine art. Really, it makes me blush when I think about it, but I actually could not stand Byzantine art. I joined the University of Crete and I wanted to do Hellenistic sculpture. And I was thinking, as I was lamenting, I thought, oh no, I have to pass Byzantine art history. How am I going to do that? All the icons look the same. Oh my word. And then I walked into one of these, the first lessons I had on Cretan icons, and it was like, oh, I just fell in love with them and I never looked back.
That is quite interesting. I hear a lot of scholars, Byzantine scholars today, that have exactly the same story. They did not really plan to go into Byzantine studies, but they actually did. So something happened.
I always tell my students, never always give something. If you think that you don't like something, just give it a second chance. Never say never to anything, because, you know, if I had said no to Byzantine art, I would never, you know, have been so happy doing Byzantine art. So yeah, always give a second chance to things.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for the introduction. And so we came here today to talk about your one of the new books that you edited based on a conference, if I'm not mistaken. So how did you come to write this book, and what inspired you to write it?
Well, the book is part of the proceedings of the Spring Byzantine Symposia, which is they originated, in fact, in the University of Birmingham. The University of Birmingham is where it's their home, basically, with the great and late Professor Breyer, who started them. And then they took a life of their own. They're now an annual thing in the United Kingdom, internationally acclaimed. Scholars attend them. And every year, a university in the United Kingdom who has a Byzantinist in situ organizes them. But of course, every 2 years they go back to their home, to their mummy, the University of Birmingham. The University of Birmingham always, I think it's every 2 years, every third year. So yes, at the Open University, it was, well, I volunteered, it was my turn anyway. And I thought I will do something about the wider Mediterranean at the time. It's my subject anyway. I specialize in Venetian Crete. Cross-cultural interaction between mainly the Greek Orthodox element and the Italian Roman Catholic element, how these two groups coexisted in the wider Mediterranean, and how the society was affected and developed from this forced interaction to begin with. So I thought, yes, it's maybe it would be interesting to do something with the wider Mediterranean. And the subtitle, Whose Mediterranean Is It Anyway? Actually, it was when I first came to the United Kingdom, it was a comedy series on TV, which was called Whose Line Is It Anyway? So I just kind of got it. I thought it would be funny for those of the British colleagues who actually got the joke. But yes, that was it. Whose Mediterranean is it anyway? And my idea was that Mediterranean belongs to nobody and to everybody, if you see what I mean. I mean, the whole point is that we all part of a global universe, and we have nothing to divide. I was hoping that was really the end product, will be that we're all humans and we need to coexist peacefully, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things when I was reading the book, as I do study medieval Europe at large, and especially more Mediterranean, because I'm also from Greece. So I think I did see that aspect in the book that, you know, it's so complicated if you really think about it, and you don't really see that on the surface. You have to really dig into some of the details.
And as I make, sorry, I just want to make sure I make that very clear in the introduction, that obviously within the confines of the specific conference, the conference was over 2 days. Of course, the Whose Mediterranean Is It Anyway? It includes in that Mediterranean, in that 1204 to 6069, we have all other ethnic groups and religions, of course, the Muslim element, the Jewish people. I mean, so many people live and coexist in the Mediterranean. But as I made very specific in the introduction, I didn't have the capacity to deal with all of this. It's a very broad obviously subject, and I would have needed probably a week. It is, I hope in the future to have a conference, to organize a conference that includes all the other elements interacting with the Christian element, if you see what I mean. But I just wanted to focus specifically on the areas where the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic were trying to get together, if you see what I mean, to work together.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Absolutely. And so let's dive into the book a little bit then. So you said 1204, and as we know, it's when Constantinople fell to the Fourth Crusade. What changed after 1204 that wasn't there before, in broader terms, when it comes to this cross-cultural interaction?
I think what changes primarily, it's the vulnerability of the empire. Of course, the empire that never before was, well, the empire, the capital was threatened many times, but never before had this catastrophe. It was never faced with this catastrophe. And of course, everything changes. All of a sudden, the territories have to, as I said, coexist with other people. Sorry, let me take a step back, because of course, I'm not saying that 1204, the Roman Catholics or the Westerns or the Latins or whatever name you want to call them, just all appear all of a sudden in Byzantium. Of course there were before. Of course there was interaction before Constantinople and Venice. It's just by seizing the capital, the structure changes. And all of a sudden, this dynamic we had, like the empire, it's like you have the emperor who was like, well, the ruler, let's say, of the Mediterranean. This power shifts anymore. He's not the ruler of the Mediterranean. Other powers come into forces, and the balance tips to the West, to the Roman Catholics or Latins or whatever name you want to call them. So the empire kind of is under, while all this time used to be above, if that makes sense. The power shifts. It changes. There's no more. If you understand what I'm saying, the emperor, it's just the whole thing collapses, certainly economically.
And that was something that the Byzantines did not see before, right? It's something that it's the first time they saw their precious city fall to somebody else, correct?
Exactly. That's what I mean, because of course it is generally accepted that the Battle of Magicert in 1071, it has been labeled as the beginning of the end. It's basically where the shift happens, with Romanos IV losing that battle in Magicert, and then the vulnerability of the empire and the army and the internal strifes, this kind of civil backstabbing in the court, all this, they're all exposed. And 1071 is, well, regarded by many historians as the beginning of the end. And then finally we have 1204, and then there's no way back. I think Constantinople never, and the empire never recovers from that. Although 1261, we have Michael VIII, but we know the empire is financially dependent on the Genoese, the Venetians. It's in ruins. We still have a civil war. I mean, yeah, it's just, it's no more, basically.
Yeah.
It sounds as if I'm narrating a doomsday scenario. I'm so sorry. It's just really, then, oh, there's no more. Sorry, but this is history. I'm not trying to be, you know, trying to make it more black than it was, but that is, I'm sorry. I do apologize to the listeners if they think that it's like a doomsday scenario that I'm really painting here.
No, it's definitely a different time from what we see in the past.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a doomsday, but definitely a different setting, more that they did not see in the past. Mm. So looking into your book, you have decided to split and curate the book in four distinct categories based on geography. Mm-hmm. So we have the chapters about, you know, evidence from Crete, Cyprus, the Peloponnese, and then evidence from the wider Mediterranean. Why this order and why these specific areas?
The order is very specific. As I said, I specialize in Venetian Crete, and as you very well know, you being Greek, if we do not say nice things about our house, the roof will fall on your head, and the benefs me to spiti mas ta pes na mas plakosi. So I had to start with Crete. No, jokes aside. Crete, as far as I'm concerned, and apart from the fact that, as I said, that's my research area, It's an excellent case study for this cross-cultural interaction between the Greeks and the Latins. We have a stable Venetian rule between 1204 and 6069, uninterrupted, where the Venetians actually have the ability to build the state or what they had in mind, and the law, everything works there uninterrupted. And they considered Crete the most precious possession in the Mediterranean, which is a term actually, a sentence I'm shamelessly nicking it from Professor Maria Georgopoulou, who has put that in one of her articles. But I think she's very right, saying that it was the most precious possession in the Mediterranean. So for me, there was no, you know, we had to start from Crete. Cyprus, another stronghold. The Venetians have a great presence in Cyprus, as we know, but again, interrupted. We have Venetians, they go, they come again. It's not like on Crete. We don't have this linearity, this very, very stable rule. And of course, the Peloponnese, again, they have a very strong presence. They have Modon and Koron in the Peloponnese, which they call the twice of the Republic, when these two cities were lost, and I think around 1500? I mean, we have actually in the sources, they say that Venice has lost her two eyes in the Mediterranean. So all of these three places, very important for the Venetians. Now, their presence in the wider Mediterranean is there, obviously, we cannot underestimate it, but I thought by focusing on these three areas, which were specific to them for trade, for whatever reasons, the others will also fall into place and produce the comparative material. And effectively, I didn't want to close the book. I actually, my hope is that the baton will taken and actually continue with other colleagues, scholars, new blood to the Dalmatian coast, which is a very interesting place. We have colleagues who are already doing that. I think Maria Bulgaropoulou is working on this. There are so many areas, and I only hope that this can open up the discussion and the field further. But the structure is because I feel personally through my research that Crete, Cyprus, and the Peloponnese for the Venetians at this particular time are very, very important strongholds for the maritime power that they are.
Yeah, so throughout the book, I mean, and you see the approach that the book has taken, I was very impressed because it takes such a multidisciplinary approach. You have art, you have you have these chronicles that are being analyzed. So there's this, again, multidisciplinary analysis that the book takes. And I just appreciated, you know, the art, how it works with explaining these concepts through art, through manuscripts. What would you say is one of the most defining characteristics between these cross-cultural interactions throughout these different geographical areas?
The most defining characteristic, I mean, through my research in particular and the conference showed, is that obviously I'm an art historian and archaeologist, so my research starts from that point. But if you go in depth and you search and search, the thing that it becomes clear is just that art is not a mushroom. It just doesn't pop like a mushroom everywhere. It's part of the society, economic, trade, culturally, religious, all the circumstances come together and it's reflected in art. And that's why I said that it's very important that we have the Venetian rule in Crete, which is steady, because we can actually see how it developed. The initial hostility of the Cretan people towards the Venetian colonies, which we also have in Cyprus and the Peloponnese to begin with. And then you see how the centuries go by and this hostility subsides, not so much because all of a sudden, oh, it's paradise and it's all, they're all dancing together thinking we are friends now. No, but it's the trade. Money knows no language. No, money is the ultimate language. So the Venetians are very clever in using Crete's products, wheat, honey, wine, and of course that generates an income for the regional centers. You have people working, having more money. Everybody is being more, I don't know, content, I suppose. However, will you see that? And then also the Venetians were very clever in just let me say that, they didn't really stopped the natives from building the churches. And I mean, they had this Semo Primo Veneziani e poi Cristiani, with first Venetians and then Christians. And sometimes actually they did get in open dispute with the Pope. They had not qualms in that. When it came down to their colonies, there were first Venetians and then Christians. Having said all this, of course, you see the social and the economic strides, but religiously, yes, I can never say that the Orthodox and the Catholics saw eye to eye. Socially and economically, and the advances are far more advanced than the religious. It remains, and it remains well into the 16th century, a problem. Does it make sense what I'm saying? I'm just through art, you have all these reflections. You have, let me break it down the way I teach my students. You have a beautiful church. You kind of think this beautiful church in regional Crete. You have to start thinking, okay, it's in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sure if you have ever been to Crete, but some of these churches are really, really hard to get to. I mean, it takes ages to find these churches. You kind of think, okay, we have this beautiful church. Let's say it's 14th century. How did the people get permission? Don't forget that the colonists are Catholic, so we have a Byzantine Orthodox Church. How did the villagers get the money to invite a painter down here in the middle of nowhere to paint this church? Who visited the church? How did the priests officiate in the church? You know, so all these questions arise from a monument, and unless you answer them, then you don't really deal with the monument properly, if that makes sense. I'm sorry, I made it very convoluted. I should have started from the last bit, which is how I always talk to my students. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. I think I definitely understand that there is so much hidden under, you know, things that in the past and in the past scholarship we will have just brushed through. And I think you might be able to also second that thought, but I think most recently there has been this push to really look into the artwork, really look into these specific components that might have been misplaced in the past.
Yes, I think art is there to, it's a testimony, it's a way of connecting with the past, because it speaks to you. If you really, really look at it and listen to it, it really speaks to you, because again, from the examples, I think it's better. There are churches on Crete where you have certain Western elements. For example, I'm just going to say the most famous of them all. We have the depiction of Saint Bartholomew holding his flayed skin over his shoulder, which is his martyrdom according to the Roman Catholic Church, because according to the Greek Orthodox, he was crucified. So the fact that we have in a Byzantine Orthodox Church a saint who is also part of the Orthodox liturgy, but depicted in the way he was martyred according to the Western tradition, it tells something. It says that Catholics must have had an input in this iconography. We also, for example, another example of the different, in a different direction, we have an inscription in Selinon that specifically declares that this church, Selinon is the southwest region on Crete, the Southwest region of Crete, and it says specifically that this church was decorated by money, with money only of Orthodox people. So the fact that this is specifically, obviously, shows hostility in the first place. You can see that clearly these people did not like the fact that Catholics were kind of in their area, but it also suggests indirectly that Catholics were in fact putting money down in other areas for Byzantine churches. So do you see what I mean? It's like unraveling a whole big maze. And I think I find that fascinating. It's just like a detective work. You have to find, hopefully not a body at the end, but the truth and light. Yeah.
Indeed. It's fascinating. Have you seen any examples of, for example, Byzantine citizens from Crete and like adopting Venetian Catholic religious beliefs or the opposite? Was there any cultural exchange between these two peoples while having this cultural interaction living together in the same land?
Yes, that is an undiluted yes, which becomes a lot more prominent after 1453, the second fall of Constantinople. But the thing is that already in the 14th century, early in the first half of the 14th century, we have documents and archival evidence that we had intermarriages between Catholics and Orthodox. So we have what we call bilingual in the wider sense households, when one parent was Catholic, the other was Orthodox. Now, mostly, I have to say to begin with, it is the father, or it's the Venetian lords who come to Crete, and they're looking into marrying into local aristocracy who has the land, of course. So they marrying upper class ladies, and like that they inherit land, and that is from where the cross-cultural interaction starts. But then it expands in middle classes, obviously, not so much in the regions, but we have effectively at some point, we can very clearly see that there is the Cretan identity. It's not like I am a Venetian or a Cretan, or you know, a Catholic Venetian or a Greek Orthodox. It's the Cretan identity that encapsulates everything. And Sally McKee, who has published 3 volumes on the wills of the people from Crete, has clearly demonstrated that at some point you cannot tell by the names anymore if somebody's Greek or Latin. You cannot, the names are not a good source to make a judgment. And further to complicate things further about this duality, these wills, we have a lot of people who actually leave money in the wills and donate both to Catholic and Orthodox establishments. So you can see how things change. They completely become Cretan, I suppose. That's the bottom line, that people feel that they're from Crete. Doesn't matter if they're Venetian or Greek or Orthodox, they're just Cretan. The Cretan identity rises, and it's very clear by the 17th century.
That is so fascinating, especially talking about medieval times, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have this image in our heads, at least from previous scholarship. I know recently that there have been a lot of books that talk about it, but why do you think that is? Why do you think that's, what's the biggest driving force behind this mixture of multiple identities to create one new identity?
Well, this is what I am trying to understand myself, and also I believe that case studies like that, and I'm talking about Crete again because it is my field, but it's not only Crete, it's Cyprus, it's the Peloponnese, obviously, it's Epirus, the Ionian Islands, the Dodecanese, all of these areas are very fertile case studies, which we can learn a lot, and I'm hoping that it can teach us something to learn how to coexist peacefully, or at least trying to find a common way of coexisting together in this present world. Because, yes, we get an image, as I said, not of paradise, but an image where people found a way, despite the fact that they had differences, they just found a way to be together, to coexist. Yes, after the 1367, we don't even have any more major uprisings on Crete, you know. I'm saying 1367 because that's well before 1453. In scholarship, we assume that once 1453, Constantinople is lost, then Crete, the Cretan people say, that's it, now we can turn to Venice, which it happens, but all I'm saying, it was there, the road, the path was already open with the coexistence. And then of course the greatest example of them all is that Crete gave the world El Greco. I mean, you have a wonderful master who is able to combine everything, all his background, Byzantine, Italian, Venetian, his classical education, and just create something wonderful, beautiful. And it is because, I do believe, it's because of his cultural background, his cultural roots. Not talking only Crete, because as we know, El Greco went to Venice, to Rome, stayed in Spain. I'm talking about the whole thing, how beautiful it is when people just learn how to be with each other and learn from each other and take the best out of other cultures.
I think that's the best message that we can bring into today's world from the medieval times.
Yes, I hope so. I really hope so. Yes.
Well, that's great. So where do you see this topic developing in the future? I know you say you have prospects that hopefully this will expand and become even bigger. Where do you see this going into the future, this topic of cross-cultural interaction between Byzantium and the West?
Well, as I said, I would really like, in the next symposium, I hope that I will be able, God willing, to organize. I would really like to expand the territories, obviously. As I said, the Dalmatia coast is fantastic. We have so much to learn. I would like to bring other territories, but also, more importantly, to expand these cross-cultural interactions towards Islam, you know, also. And, of course, the very important Jewish element that we have in the Mediterranean, which is very important. I would like to see it more widely. And that's why, as I said, I put this subtitle, Whose Mediterranean Is It Anyway? Because my belief is, as I said, it belongs to nobody and to everybody. It belongs to all of us, if you see what I mean. It's a cultural development rather than somebody can claim it. But yes, I would very much like to have an outlook to Islam and the Jewish influences, interactions, the dialogue of all these elements, cultural
Indeed,
elements.
I think,
yeah,
I think that would be a great addition. Do you think there is any new forms of art that maybe this topic can expand into? I know you in the book, there is the mentioning of elephants painted in manuscripts and churches and architecture. Do you think there's any new art approaches where we can get more evidence from that particular time, something that scholars haven't seen yet?
So what do you have in mind exactly? Because I know that is Andrea Matiello's beautiful paper on the elephant on the page. It's beautiful, isn't it? Yes. Great sense of humor, excellent chapter indeed. So what exactly Can you give me what you have in mind? In order for you to ask the question, you clearly have something in mind. What do you have in mind? Let me just throw the question right back at you.
Sure. I was thinking any form of an alternative art, like have we looked at pottery? Have we looked at certain different iconographies, the way churches were built, architecture? Have we looked into, is there anything that we missed so far into looking into cross-cultural interactions when it comes to art?
Well, first of all, there is in Byzantine Art and Renaissance Europe, the book I have edited with my husband, Rembrandt Doubts. I do go into this, how a church was built. And as I mentioned earlier, it always intrigues me how in the middle of nowhere, in a village on Crete, people called for a painter to come and decorate the church. This I found it very fascinating. Also, you mentioned what you say, basically, it's material culture, which is very important. And another thing we have started looking at, again, it's the art of the poor, of course, looking art produced by the lower classes, which I think it's very, very important because, you know, Byzantium has this glamour and gold and glitter and mosaics. But actually, if you think about it, this is a very few top percentage of the population. We're talking about aristocrats or the emperor. If you think the rest of the people were really like, you know, today, common people with not many means, but they still produce art. And I think I find that in Crete, again, gives a wonderful case study, as does also the Peloponnese. Sharon Gerstel has demonstrated that wonderfully in her book. And of course, Cyprus, again. And yeah, the Dalmatian coast, etc. So if you're thinking of material culture, yes, we have a lot to look into, as you say, pottery and all of this. Absolutely. Totally.
Great. I mean, the reason why I'm asking this question is because I know, you know, I do my own research into this. And again, there's just so much to unravel, which is the reason why we're doing this podcast today to, you know, bring this into the forefront and you know, hopefully, you know, inspire to do more research into it in many other fields, many other ways of approaching things. But so more of a technical question now. What was your biggest challenge into developing this book?
My biggest challenge was to actually keep on writing to, the, you know, how busy the academics are, just making sure that I kept on reminding them the deadlines I was setting. I felt at some point like I was really a horrible person, that everybody hated me because I kept on sending emails once a month, like a calendar, you know, please remember that in 1 month I need your draft. Please remember that in 2 weeks I need your draft. So at some point I felt that everybody hated me because I was trying to keep to a time table, obviously, because I'm busy, they're busy. So, but for the rest, it was a great joy, actually. It helped me, of course, the scholars, the colleagues. It's wonderful to collaborate. You cannot exist on your own as you're a young researcher yourself, Evan. You know that unless you talk to other people, research does not happen in a vacuum. So it was wonderful for me to read with pleasure all this. I felt obviously very apprehensive sometimes. Obviously, I'm not a native speaker, so I had to edit papers, as you can see, for other Greeks, Italians, and even, you know, native speakers. So I felt a little bit, ooh, should I be doing that? Me? No. But in the end, it was just, it was totally worth it. I learned so much. I learned really, really so much. It was totally, totally worth it. I would do it again if that's what you're asking me. Yes, it was worth every single minute. But it is hard work, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to say, well, you know, best experience of my life. No, but I will do it again because I learned so much.
That's fantastic. And I mean, another thing that really surprised me with this volume is the, again, the multidisciplinary faculty that have contributed to the work. We have people in Byzantine art history, medieval Russian art, just Byzantine history in general, iconography. It's just, I see it as a lot of people with different interests and different research coming together to produce something, as you said, that if you don't meet somebody, you're not going to create research. So I that's another thing that I admire about this work as well.
Yes, and I think absolutely it's very important because all the colleagues that, I mean, they're wonderful colleagues. Personally, I think I was very lucky that they were willing to participate. And I mean, some wonderful contributions by Leslie Brubaker, Liz James, obviously, Maria Costanzo-Daiki, who has done a lot and a lot of work on the Venetian archives. My own husband, who actually works, his name is Rembrandt Doutz, he's actually a Renaissance specialist, but we have been working on Crete because obviously he has an interest from the Venetian point of view, so he can see a lot of Italian Western influences into Cretan art. So it's been very, very useful talking to him. Of course, Dionysios Stathakopoulos, who I work very closely. He's a very dear friend and colleague. We work closely together. But I don't mean that by not mentioning other people that I don't appreciate their contribution. I just try to think. So please, if for those listening, oh, Tasos Papakostas, of course. I'm just trying to think now. If I'm leaving anybody out, it's not because I loved all the contributions. I'm just really kind of panicking, thinking, whom I have left out? Whom I have left out? I'm so sorry. They're all, you know, I thought it was great reading their contributions. And I felt really privileged that they wanted to contribute.
That's amazing. Yes. So we're getting kind of to the close. And a question that I want to ask you as, you know, the editor, who would you give this book to? Who does it really talk about the most? Is it for somebody that studies Byzantine art? Is it for somebody that studies just Byzantium in general, or the West and the East connections, or is it all of these people? Like, who is the main audience of this book, according to your perspective?
I think the main audience is definitely somebody who has an interest in Byzantium, but in all fairness, I will say that it would be more interesting for people who study Renaissance and medieval Western art, because I think Byzantium is misunderstood, and it's like the marginal child in art history for sure. You know, when you know, you have Byzantine art, and then people say, oh, Michelangelo, Raphael, and this, you cannot compete with the names, primarily because Byzantine art is not about names. But people don't understand. It's 1100 years, and that art, that culture, has enormous influence in the West, certainly medieval art, and it has played an immense role in the development of the European culture, European identity. And I think people tend to forget, because all they think or know is Vasari, you know, kind of think, oh, this terrible medieval Greek style, and or they think of Gibbon, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and they don't give it a second chance. Basically, like me, before I entered into that class where it had Creta and I was thinking, oh, they all look the same, how horrible, no, why should I? No. It is so much more to it. People don't understand how important this culture is for Europe. And I'm not saying that Europe is the beginning and the end, but no, but Europe, again, is part of the global. But Byzantium has really played a major role in contributing to the development of that European culture. And I think it's about time that we found our Byzantium found its way into the Western scholarship for real. I mean, we tend to forget that Bellini, Crivelli, we have wonderful Italian and Venetian painters who were very much exposed to Byzantine art. And people tend to, of the Medici, the Medici had Byzantine icons, the Bargello Pantocrator, the mosaic icon, it was in the Lorenzo de' Medici. And people, scholars think, well, they cannot explain that because Vasari says that, and then how the Medici, which is the equivalent of the Renaissance, how is it possible that they had so many Byzantine icons? Yeah, because if you look closer, Byzantine icons are just really precious, they're beautiful objects. So yes, we need to look closer. Obviously, again, I'm a Byzantinist. Of course, I'm going to say nice things about Byzantium, but but yes, I think it, if nothing else, it's 1100 years, 1100 years of culture. Surely it's worth our efforts.
Definitely. And do you think it's changing? Do you think that scholars from, you know, from Europe and, again, from the Greek world and from other parts of the scholastic arena, do you think they're changing their perspective on this, on what you just said?
I hope so. Certainly there is some effort to reconsider the Paleologan times, which is considered a decline. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, Byzantine icons have always were important in the modern art, because we have a lot of Russian modern painters who clearly were influenced by icons. You have like Malevich, for example. You have Matisse, who was very enamored by them. So there's certainly the modern, early modern, I'm just getting very confused with that, because early modern people, usually by early modern, they refer to us, medieval and Renaissance. Well, for me, early modern is the early 20th century, where we have Picasso, Matisse. So, yeah, somebody needs to sort out the terminology, because I totally don't agree with it. But anyway, so the early 20th century artists, there is an interest. We know that Matisse was completely besotted by the icons and what they stand. So modern art has an understanding. I mean, probably you know that Rothko is considered this, it has this mysticism and, you know, it has this element of iconic atmosphere. But I'm not sure if it's really because they understand what an icon is and how important it is for the development of the European culture, or they just see it as an influence, a kind of little tiny piece of a puzzle in the development of modernity. And I'm afraid it's the latter. And again, I don't agree, but I don't want to go into a dialogue about a discussion about modernity or what is early modern, because it's confusing. I don't believe we should be called early modern, because it's very confusing. Medieval Renaissance, it's fine. Early modern, as I said, for me, when I say early modern, it's early 20th century when it starts. Anyway, forget about it. Delete the last 5 minutes of this, because I know I'm probably going to create a whole lot. I can see a debate escalating. Please delete it. No. But yes.
Okay, yeah. And again, the way I'm asking these questions is because, you know, reading this book, you know, it brings you so many questions afterwards, after you read it. It makes you think about these things, and it's interesting.
Well, thank you for saying that. It's very kind of you to find. Well, the whole point is, as I said, my intention was not to give answers. My intention was primarily to raise more questions and continue from there, because I don't, you know, can you imagine if let's say somebody said that, oh, somebody has written about the Sistine Chapel and Michelangelo, that's it, we don't need to deal with Michelangelo anymore, that's it, we know everything there is to know. No, the whole point is that we keep revisiting things, and by the more we look at them, the more we learn. So yes, the more questions we have, the better it is for scholarship. These books are not meant to give the definitive answers. It's not like, oh, this is the gospel and the only truth. No, it's for opening more doors, more questions, and even questions that will question that book. I think if people come and question what it is written in that book, I think the book will have made its point. Yes, it's been challenged, totally.
You couldn't have said it better. Well, Angeliki, we've taken a lot of your time and we thank you so much. I would like to ask one last question before you go. What are you up to nowadays? Do you have any other interesting projects that you're working on?
Well, yeah, probably you probably know the most recent book that has come out is Hell in the Byzantine World, a two-volume book that has basically, it does what it says in the name, Hell in the Byzantine World. It deals with representations of hell, Byzantine, to be specific, representations of hell, Crete, Cyprus, Cappadocia, the Peloponnese, mainland Greece. We have also the historic background of the Byzantine period and archival material supporting evidence for punishment. So it took a lot of time. That was a Leverhulme-funded project, international networks. It took a lot of time. It came out last October. And I think I'm still catching my breath from that because it was really hard work. And finally we finished, so we're still, yay! And we did it even while it was in the middle of the COVID. We were still kind of editing the book when COVID hit the world. So I'm still recovering from that. But a database is coming. So watch this space, a database with all the material from Crete, and hopefully we will launch in October, as in this October, next month. It will be free of charge. People can subscribe and have a look at the material and all the punishments in hell on Crete. So watch this space.
Well, that sounds an awesome project, and I can't wait to see it myself. So. Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, again, thank you for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and take care.